we have two terrific opening keynote speakers, and they're very different in their perspectives. They both look at disability and employment, but their wealth of experience comes from different angles. Barbara Murray, who we, and you have the bio, so please read the full ones, but Barbara Murray, who we often refer to at the UN as the ILO lady, is the senior disability specialist in the International Labor Office, Skills and Employment Department. She has worked around the world, although she specializes on training and employment in East Africa and Southeast Asia. She represents the ILO on the Interagency Task Force on the CRPD and in the newly created UN Partnership on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. So Barbara's going to give us a very wide-ranging, very diverse, very geographically diverse perspective on disability and employment. Susan Scott Parker, who founded the Employers Forum on Disability over 20 years ago in the United Kingdom, is the person that I, as I said yesterday, send my students to when they ask, what are good practices as far as employment? Because again, so often the trope is to demonize employers, to talk about the terrible employers. And 20-something years ago, Susan said, wait a minute, if we keep pushing back against employers and excluding them and we don't engage them, who's going to hire the disabled people? Good question. But it's easier to complain and easier to push aside than it is to engage. And so for 20 years, with now nearly 400 member companies, Susan has worked on engaging employers in a non-confrontational, facilitated, cooperative manner that has increased disability and employment and has really created a best practice. So we're going to hear about that experience, which is no less rich, but is much more focused and has a lot of depth on how to engage with employers. Both will offer us invaluable insights. I'm grateful to them for being here, and I turn over to Barbara.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm really honored. In the time available, if I don't get stopped, I want to talk to you about what empirical evidence there is about finding and keeping jobs, and jobs by persons with disabilities, in high and low income countries. And I want to look at the trends in employment and work opportunities there. And then I want to talk a bit about the factors underlying the employment rates in the open labour market from the side of the disabled job seeker or the worker with a disability, and very briefly from the employer's perspective, although that is going to be dealt with in much more detail by Susan. And then which way forward is the end. So let's have a look first at what we know about empirically about the employment of persons with disabilities. Well, you're all familiar, I'm sure, with the World Report on Disability produced by the WHO and the World Bank in June, published in June of 2011. The new disability prevalence rate contained in that report says that rather than the estimate previously used of 10%, that at least 15% of the world population has a disability, if not 19%, depending on the way in which you define the disability thresholds. So applying that to people, that estimate to people with disabilities of working age, you have at least 780 million people with disabilities worldwide who either have a job or are looking for a job or are unemployed. Of those, about 110 million experience significant difficulties in functioning. So that's all from the World Report. And it's really very interesting that for the first time we do have some empirical evidence, but as when you go and look, and we'll be looking in a bit more detail at what the World Report says about different countries around the world, you can see that there's a challenge for all researchers and central statistics offices to try and clarify some of the puzzles that emerge from that. So most people with disabilities live in developing countries, and the informal economy is widespread, so many are looking for jobs or are working in parts of the economy which are not covered by legislation or more difficult to reach with legislation. We don't really know about the labour market situation of persons with disabilities in most countries. I'm talking about official statistics now, the labour force surveys that are conducted in most countries around the world. Of course, in the US and in Canada and Australia and New Zealand, we do have regular, comparable over time information, but most countries, it's very difficult to find anything other than the odd survey findings to give you a clue about where people with disabilities are with regard to work. And so the common patterns that we find are lower employment rates in the general labour force, somewhat higher unemployment rates, and really most significant, much lower labour force participation rates among persons with disabilities. So people with disabilities are not actively looking for jobs in countries which have formal labour markets and which large formal labour markets and which gather information about this. Often in part-time and low-paid work, that is a common complaint in many countries or a common pattern in many countries. And sometimes that means that people are in informal working conditions, informal working conditions in the formal economy. So precarious work, informal contracts, and so on. And certain people with certain types of disability face much greater disabilities. People with intellectual disabilities, people with mental health or psychosocial disabilities are most at risk. So as the World Report states, the global data sets which were used here, which is the World Health Survey and the Global Burden of Disease Survey, they don't provide definitive estimates, and there is an urgent need for more robust, comparable, and complete data collection everywhere. So let's look briefly then at what we know about the situation in low-income countries and high-income countries, and this is drawn from the World Report once again. Here we see that according to the information that is provided in that report, women with disabilities have a far lower employment rate than men with disabilities, and that there is a difference over time. So this is really as far as we can get at the moment, but I think that this is the beginning. I think a lot more work needs to be done to clarify some of the interesting data which is provided in the World Report. We have data for low-income countries which in some cases fits the pattern of lower employment rates and so on. But there are some countries, like for example for Zambia and Malawi, we have an employment rate reported for people with disabilities which is almost the same as for non-disabled people. And so it raises the question of how employment is defined or understood in those kind of surveys. Okay, enough of statistics. It's still early in the morning. I'll move on now to trends. Trends in work and employment opportunities. We know most about the trends in high-income countries. And so, of course, there, dating back over years, you still have you have sheltered employment and sheltered workshops in most countries that have been trying for a long time to provide job opportunities for persons with disabilities. There has been a lot of debate about these workshops, as you know. In fact, many countries have attempted to encourage those running these workshops to move a percentage of people with disabilities every year into a more open work option. It's not easy when people with disabilities have been working maybe 18, 19, 20 years in these kind of settings, so they maybe feel very insecure about moving out. Some countries have actually tried to close these workshops down. New Zealand has closed down the sheltered workshops in spite of some objections on the part of disability advocates, particularly parents. Australia attempted to do this, but due to persistent lobbying on the part of parents, of people with disabilities availing of these services, the government backed down. But in any case, there is a lot of change needed in these centres, and the working conditions are certainly under review. Because many people acquire a disability while in working age, of course, open employment was always an option for people who had completed their education and completed their training and had work experience. So that is certainly there, and of course the trend is now to try and increase that option. And self-employment in high-income countries is there to a certain extent, but because it's not as widespread as you would imagine, because of the regulations governing registering small businesses and the expense associated with that. So the policy trends are trying to shift people from sheltered into open employment or self-employment. And because for many people this was a very difficult shift to make, I think it was in the US, the supported employment model involving on-the-job training with a job coach and ongoing support if required has proved very successful as a first stepping stone for people who are trying to move towards the open labour market. This was originally introduced for people with intellectual disabilities, but the success of this model has meant that it is now used much more widely for people with all types of disabilities. So the aim is for people to pass through supported employment and then get a full-time job. We don't have full information about the extent to which people actually make that full transition. Some people stay in the supported employment arrangements for their lives, but the evidence that we do have from some countries is that this is more effective in terms of people's job satisfaction and quality of life. Social firms were developed in Italy following the closure of the huge mental asylums in the mid-70s, where people with mental health or psychosocial disabilities had to leave these asylums, and of course, and this often happens, there were no other arrangements made for them. And when it became clear that many were on the streets, begging for a living, many of the people who had formerly been involved in providing services in the mental asylums created the social firms model. The social firms involve the employment of people with disabilities and people who are otherwise socially disadvantaged with a manager or somebody supporting the whole thing. So that proved to be very successful. It mostly involves restaurants or nightclubs or cafes, that kind of arrangement. And the European Union is now trying to promote this approach through the programs it has, including in countries in developing countries. I can't not mention telework. This is a great advantage now for people who have difficulty getting through to and from a formal place of work. So a lot of people can work from home or from somewhere near home without having to travel using telework. And that is most applicable in countries which have reliable information and communications technology infrastructures, like here or in the States, but not in all developing countries. So what about the low-income countries? Well, I have a lot of question marks in this slide. You do have some sheltered workshops which have usually been set up under a project funded by some international donor in the past. But you don't have this as a general model of service provision for people with disabilities in most of the developing countries that I am familiar with. You have limited open employment due to the fact that informal employment is the most common way in which people earn a living. The estimate is in developing countries that between 35 and 90% of people work in the informal, unregulated economy, which could be hazardous and not covered by legislation and so on. So self-employment is most important in these countries. There are some examples of supported employment, but once again, often projects. And from what we can see, when the projects finish, it's very hard for those supported employment arrangements to continue because of the lack of government ongoing support for those. Social firms are also being tried out, but not yet widespread. And work for informal businesses, I guess, is the other main option that people with disabilities face in those developing countries. We don't really have information. This is why I've put question marks here. So for all of those in this room who are interested in doing some useful research, you could have a look and see what you can find out. So let's look at the vision then. Jody mentioned in her opening remarks this is a time of remarkable transition for people with disabilities. And indeed, the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities embodies the vision with regard to work and employment. So there's a new policy approach involved here, and that can be summarised as follows, that people with disabilities should have the right to the opportunity to gain a living by work which they freely choose or accept in a labour market and work environment that is open, inclusive and accessible. Doesn't take long to say that, but I think in terms of implementation, it's going to take a long, long time indeed. This is drawn from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the right to work. So what the CRPD is asking countries around the world to do is shift from having people with disabilities involved in sheltered workshops, in segregated employment somewhere, move people to the open labour market. And in developing countries, the CRPD is requiring states ratified, I believe it's 113 states now, to move people with disabilities from survival type of self-employment activities, petty trading, to viable small enterprises that can provide an opportunity for growth and a good standard of living for them. Very importantly throughout, the CRPD is trying to bring people with disabilities under legal protection, because quite often people with disabilities were working in situations like in sheltered workshops, where they weren't covered by any of the employment laws at all. So no rights to sick pay, no rights to holidays, no rights to minimum wage, etc., etc. That is to change, and the employment laws are to apply to people with disabilities in all forms of employment. And very importantly, I guess, a move from people with disabilities having no choice, being expected to accept what is just arranged for them in terms of work, to work freely chosen or accepted. And so let's just apply that concept of freely choosing or accepting work to the overview I just provided you with. At the moment, I would say that in many countries, people with disabilities are being channeled to sheltered employment, to supported employment, or to social firms. That is my theory. Up to you researchers to go and test that. There is an element of choice, I guess, when it comes to self-employment, because most of the training for entrepreneurship development does have this kind of this self-exclusion mechanism at the beginning, when people do the tests about whether they are actually going to be good entrepreneurs, whether they're good risk takers and so on. An element of choice there. And there's greater choice when it comes to open employment or working for informal businesses. But we have a long way to go to realise what is provided for in the convention. So my trusty timekeeper has just told me, more or less, that I should really speed up. So I won't talk too much about the supply side factors influencing employment choices of persons with disabilities. You all know that it really makes a big difference if somebody has not been to school at all or hasn't had the training in employable skills. So you're really at a disadvantage, not to do with your impairment necessarily, but because you cannot offer the kind of things that employers are looking for. Choices are also influenced by legal and policy measures. And there we've had a lot of discussion already in the working groups about the benefits trap that some people with disabilities find themselves in. They are unable to take jobs for fear of losing their benefits. So it's very important to see what countries are doing to try and build a bridge between the benefit situation and the open labour market. The cost factors, cost of going to work, of being able to have the kind of equipment you need to get to work, and then the motivational factors, often very important. Historically, many people with disabilities have become discouraged, have internalized the negative attitudes that people generally have of them and their capacity to work, and that can undermine their motivation. So let me just see what I'm going to end on then, because with regard to the employers' side, I leave that to Susan to talk about. So what's the way forward in developing countries and in high-income countries? Well, you know, as I mentioned, there is this struggle going on between the government and between the service providers and the advocates with regard to sheltered employment. But really the policy aim is to see this, if at all, as a transitional occupation for people on their way to the open labour market, or to a more open labour market opportunity. There needs to be much more public support for supported employment, because the evidence on that is that it is much higher quality and brings people with disabilities closer to their desired aim of having a decent job. And I know in the UK there has been a closure of some sheltered workshops and a move to invest more public funds in supported employment. Of course, there needs to be much greater promotion of private sector involvement in providing employment opportunities. Can I pause for a minute and ask my trusty timekeeper, are you going on 20 minutes or 25 minutes there? 20 minutes, okay, so I have a bit of leeway, folks, because I thought I had 25 minutes. So it's very important also that the governments promote employment opportunities. No point in trying to get the private sector to provide employment for persons with disabilities if the government doesn't lead the way. And, you know, it's interesting to see some of the laws where there are quota laws in place. Sometimes the quota only applies to the private sector, not to the public sector. So, of course, employers are asking, why on earth is that? There should be greater employer involvement in opening options, in different options, like has been done in France and Germany, different ways in which employers can come up with ideas to promote opportunities for persons with disabilities. Trade union involvement is quite important too, especially where there are strong affirmative action measures to support the workers with disabilities. Trade union support will ensure that other workers don't feel that they are hard done by. And of course, then we need a new role for disabled persons organisations. Having successfully advocated for the convention, the role, I think, needs to change to be a much more advisory role. In helping, assisting, supporting all the key actors in moving forward. So what about low-income countries then? Well, once again, you need to try, and the states need to try and promote public and private sector employment opportunities insofar as they exist. And in a globalised world, of course, you have quite a lot of multinationals involved in developing countries, and they have corporate social responsibility policies which support the employment of persons with disabilities. So there are chances there to promote employment opportunities in the formal sector. But because most people in developing countries work in the informal economy, there needs to be much stronger support to enterprise and entrepreneurship development. And linked to that, much stronger support for access to the general business development services that are in place in many of those countries to advise entrepreneurs and help them solve the problems that they're facing, and also access to microcredit. This came up yesterday. I won't dwell on it. States need to reach out to the informal economy, and this is a real challenge, I guess, because there is no obligation for the informal economy enterprises to obey any laws. So, you know, it's a challenge for governments to try and encourage or incentivize these enterprises to formalize so that there are better safety and health conditions and so on. And once again, advocacy and advisory roles for disabled persons organizations need to emerge. I'll just end by saying, you know, I think there is a huge change required all round. We haven't really talked about vested interest yet, but, you know, I hear this said quite a lot, that people who have run services for years and feel they're doing a good job, and they have in the past, but they need to change now. So service providers, all service providers, particularly sheltered workshop providers and vocational training providers, need to change their approach. Roles of disability advocates have already said it. I think there needs to be a new role carved out. And social partners, employers and workers, as well as civil society, need to be involved. And just to end with once again emphasising that certain types of services and programmes really need to change rapidly. And as I said just a moment ago, these are sheltered employment and vocational training centres. Thank you for your attention.
And good morning, everybody. I don't have many slides because I get confused. I can never remember what I thought I was going to talk about. I've got a couple up there, just to give you a flavor for the membership mainly. So thank you very much for the invitation to come home, because maybe what didn't appear in that intro was I am Canadian. Some of you will have been to Fort McLeod, Alberta, I'm sure. I was there for 6 weeks. I don't remember it that well, but Alberta certainly is my home. And I've been in the UK a long time, and my job this morning is to try to somehow capture in 23 minutes something about what we've learned when it comes to moving business from unwilling and unable to do what we want it to do to not just willing and able, but actually doing it. A little bit first about us. The premise here is that for 20 years, I've had the worst sales job in the world. It runs, I want you to pay to join something that's going to tell you you've got it wrong, about people your board doesn't rate, that you don't recall ever having met, and there's no reward you can spot instantly for doing this. So the fact that we've survived, I regard as a huge performance indicator of success. Impact is a little trickier to measure. But the point I wanted to make is these organizations paid to join an organization where, in effect, they're joint funding a central expert resource that's focused on them as the most important client in the room. Our job is to enable these companies to become what we call disability confident. I'm going to talk about what that actually means in a second. Our job is to help them to get to the point where senior players can justify investing in changing, where people begin to see that we're moving disability from something to do with, you know, charities and doctors and governments and damage and deficit, to something to do with this business. I'm learning how it affects my business, and to do with investment in human potential. And that organizations begin to understand that by learning how to adapt for human beings, they become better at doing what they want to do in terms of running their organization. A bit on language. I'm going to shift between disabled person and persons with disabilities and people with disabilities, because we have to acknowledge and honor the preferences of people with disabilities that we work with. The disability lobby, many in Europe, insist on being called disabled people on the grounds that they're disabled by society's refusal to give them a bus they can get on. And some people, often those who develop disabilities later in life, prefer to be a person or people with disabilities. And then I had an extraordinary conversation with someone born with cerebral palsy, whose entire life could neither bathe, feed, dress, feed himself, spoke with a very serious speech impediment, so we needed an interpreter. And he said to me once, "Susan, do you think of yourself as a person with female bits?" And so We move back and forth on this one. I just thought I should mention that in case anybody is sensitive to these issues. We tell the employer, we would rather you said the wrong thing than don't talk about it at all. And ask people what they prefer. Start that conversation. I'm also going to talk about adjustments, not accommodation, because we know that people in work hear the language of accommodation is just for disabled people. Special treatment, maybe. Legal obligation, absolutely. Wouldn't do it if the law didn't require it. Whereas we adjust as employers for everybody, really, for any good. And so if I allow someone to start at 10 because they have a 90-year-old mother, they have children, they have severe arthritis and they're stiff in the mornings, we're adjusting. And I'm talking about the private sector particularly this morning, but please hear that the public sector, you know, as Barbara was saying, not only need to be seen to be good, are not good. And that we need to understand why governments that are now ratifying this convention struggle to employ people with disabilities themselves. Because if we don't understand the obstacles they encounter, we can't remove them. So my focus really is on the opportunity now. Second slide, just so you can see the second list. Obviously, many of the members in this group, and they pay up to £20,000 a year for the privilege of being told they've got it wrong, yeah? So that they can actually work together in a way that opens up new ways of thinking and doing. I'm not going there. My focus today really is on the opportunity that we've got now to shift this system that consistently does not bring people with disabilities into work in any country for whatever reasons linked to particular systems. We can shift the system by simply putting as much energy into making it easier for the employer to say yes as we now put into trying to enable the individual to approach the world of work in general. We need to take a whole systems view. Too much research is on components of the puzzle. We need to look at how people move through the journeys that take them from preparing for to finding work. And even more importantly, we need to look at what happens as the employers move through a process of trying to attract candidates, assess them, appoint them, and bring them in. I'm not very good at slides. Trust me, Barbara. We'll get there in a second. I think the challenge here is that we need to be able to identify, as we look at those processes, the obstacles that are in the control of the business or the employer and the obstacles that are not. A very important statistic in the UK, 25% of disabled job seekers had turned down a job. Now that's turned down the job because they couldn't get on the bus, no accessible transport. 9% of those job seekers blamed the employer. Government ministers blamed the employer. What we have endemic in the system is low expectations on both sides. Low expectations that disabled people probably aren't up to competing for work, and low expectations of the employer and their willingness to actually hire people on the basis of capability. People tend to live up to expectations. People tend to live up to both high expectations and low expectations. And so if the service providers in the middle don't really believe their people can compete, and don't really believe that employers are going to give them a fair deal, golly gee, it doesn't work. I did a conference in Berlin where, one, there were no disabled people in the room. And when the organizer, I asked, why? Oh, where are these people? He said, well, you couldn't ask me to bring disabled people and put them in front of 100 employers. He said, no, you want me to persuade these employers to hire people you won't even bring into the room. So we've had 20 years trying to persuade influential business leaders to change the way they look at the world. Because that's actually what we're doing. When they look out there now, they don't see disabled people in that world. Whose job is it to do that? Is that a government job, to change the way business leaders see the world? Is it NGOs? And what's perfectly clear to me is that the way we do it now doesn't work. The messages aren't working. And I want us to remember that employers actually do not go home and get beaten up by their mothers, wives, lovers, for treating disabled people badly. As far as they're concerned, their attitudes reflect those of the society in which we operate. And certainly any strategies designed to influence the small business community, you have to change the way the society thinks, which is why the story about the shift on epilepsy is so encouraging. It can be done, but it needs to be done very carefully and systematically. What we have to accept is that most people, not just employers, still struggle to get it. If I say to an audience of employers, is it fundamentally the same, fundamentally no different, to turn me down for a job because I'm disabled than to turn me down because I'm a woman or an ethnic minority? Most people do not believe deep down it is fundamentally not really different. It still feels different, which is why we recently had an article in the Globe and Mail that talked about how equality now is accepted across Canada, and it listed all sorts of deviant groups that Canadians regard as okay, women, ethnic minorities. No reference to disability in that article. That was last week. Well, maybe this week. I'm a little confused where I am. And we've just had an official in the department responsible for our welfare to work program say in front of my member companies, I think when one of them had the temerity to say, well, we're doing this for talent, well, I think you'll find that the evidence isn't really there on the talent front. And this is the government department that is trying to persuade employers to hire people. We need to make whoever is involved in this world of creating legal frameworks, getting the balance right, so we've got rights-based legislation there, needs to also, and even more importantly than putting the law there, explain why it was needed and how discrimination actually works for people with disabilities. Whose job is it to explain what it really means in practice? And so what we've got still around the world tends to be a system stuck in time, with employers on one side, disabled people on another, and a maze of agencies and government departments and well-intentioned people in the middle. In some developing countries, fewer in the middle, but still very little direct contact between business and disabled individuals. The first thing we did was a leadership development program for disabled people that brought high-capacity disabled individuals on a scholarship program into the companies to do management training in-house alongside managers in companies like Barclays and Royal Mail and so on. That personal contact is absolutely crucial if you're going to get business leaders to buy in, that we're not talking about mythological creatures, we're talking about people like, he's interesting, look at what he can do. No one out there is systematically working to create a process that an employer can turn to who's well-intentioned and wants to recruit people with disabilities. It's all one-off and inconsistent. And the focus on the law usually is hugely counterproductive. The message in terms of legal compliance approach is I'm only going to treat you fairly if I have to. I'm only going to treat you properly if I have to. Imagine how that's heard across the company and by disabled people themselves. Which is why best practice and being able to define best practice is so crucial. The scale of the gap in terms of what's available to the well-intentioned employer, because if you can't do it for that guy, you sure can't do it for the hostile. The gap for the well-intentioned employer is that we have in circulation, mainly sold, 8 million guides on how to actually manage people with different kinds of impairments, how you manage performance management situations where the performance is impacted by the disability and so on. 8 million guides, that mainly in the UK, but we've also got guides now going out in South Africa, Moscow, Australia. Malta just did one on welcoming disabled customers in Maltese, which is fascinating, and I do hope it says what we think it says. But the point here is no one is giving the employer stuff they can use to train their own people in how to become disability competent. And this concept of disability competence has become absolutely crucial. If people are going to change their behavior, they need to know what to do. Some of you heard me say yesterday, we had a minister recently saying employers need to descale their eyes. Well, if you just tell an employer to descale their eyes, he might say, okay, and that just doesn't get you anywhere at all. If you tell them these are the 10 things you have to do, these people need to learn how to do that, suddenly you're in a very different place. So if I could have my slide for disability confidence, if you can find it there. What we've done is to say, if you're going to change, you need to know the destination. And what we need are organizations that are disability confident. This is best practice as we define it, at delivery. They need to understand how disability affects the business, their talent pools, their employees, their customers. So 1 in 3 people, disabled or close to someone who is all Goldman Sachs needs in terms of understanding. Some companies looking at demographics, the fact that 1 in 3 people aged 50 to 64 will have a disability. means a disability-competent company knows how to adapt so that an aging workforce continues to contribute to the business. The fourth little number there, no, so it goes, understand how it affects the business, remove obstacles for groups, so blind people can get through your online recruitment system, fat chance, deaf people can get through your induction videos because they're subtitled, maybe, people with mental health problems aren't knocked out by your occupational health physicians who run blanket exclusions, etc., etc. And then the third bit is you make adjustments for individuals so they can do the job because no two human beings are going to be the same. Now, the premise that underpins that, of course, is rights-based legislation. This is how you take the obligation to treat people fairly and transform it in practical terms in the business. What we've also got is don't make assumptions about what people can do on the basis of a label at the bottom. The premise here is that the pitch to the business is talent, productivity, customer access, brand reputation, customer satisfaction, and you get all that by becoming disability confident. So there's never been a greater opportunity to define best practice. We spent 15 years not just defining this, putting the toolkits behind it, but creating the standard, the disability standard. We can now measure what KPMG, Barclays, Serco, we can measure their performance across the organization and determine the extent to which they've actually got there. And we can help them to benchmark their performance against their clients and their competitors. What we're saying is that best practice is in their interest because it helps them to simplify the complexity they face as they seek to manage often inconsistent, incoherent legislation and technical standards worldwide. And so these laws are often drafted without reference to employers or their reality and without an understanding of how discrimination is actually delivered, if you like, through the employer's way of working. So just from a quick example of some of the things you see, it is legal in many countries to discriminate on the grounds of blanket exclusions. Doctors say we won't hire people with epilepsy. I call it the ICS, arthritics, asthmatics, epileptics. You know, they just have this long list of people that they do pre-employment medicals, and they just won't hire them. Now, it's legal in many countries to do that. And there is no best practice alternative for the company trying to figure out what to do. They've been told that doctors are the answer. I see nothing in our debate so far about the impact of disability incompetent medical professions on all this. Occupational health is a huge problem for us. Next, you've got legal definitions regarding who is genuinely disabled in this country that are so medically and narrowly focused that they distort the understanding of the employer about who we're really talking about. In Brazil, if you've got dyslexia and you can't get through the online application form, you've got a severe stammer and you can't get through the interview, you're not disabled. The law doesn't count you because they've got this other narrow list. My favorite Brazil story is an individual with one leg 3.4 centimeters shorter than the other. The employer's hiring them and thinks, okay, well, maybe I don't even have to pay the fine now for the quota. Quota says it has to be 4.3 centimeters shorter. The next little bit you see is the law contradicting itself. So the employer is told I have to hire people on the basis of their capability, and they're told in the same country they have to hire people on the basis of their disability and their damage because they're trying to run rights-based and quotas at the same time. So the employer just kind of blanks on that complexity and can't cope with it. Or the law enforces adversarial relationships. Every applicant is a potential litigant. But my point here is that legislation needs to be credible in the eyes of both people with disabilities and the business community if it's really going to work. And it is possible for business to understand the positioning that disability should be seen as a rights-based issue. In the UK, we had a quota when we were set up, and by 1994, 60 major employers were actively lobbying in favor of civil rights legislation, employment rights legislation, because they wanted to manage it alongside race and gender and just manage it in a sensible way. I wanted to shift now and take a look at the whole question of, I don't want to do that anymore. I think the point here is that best practice enables the company to deliver legal compliance, but in a way which delivers mutual benefit to the business and disabled people. And we've defined this as a new business case. On our website, you'll see business case. This is where we're trying to put together the evidence that if you're disability competent, you're actually going to enhance business performance Oh, and by the way, that delivers benefits for disabled people because you're now much better at recruiting and serving disabled customers. So please check out that website. Give us the case studies you've got. You'll see that Lloyds Bank have just re-engineered the way they deliver adjustments for their employees. They've got evidence now across 3,000 employees who've come through, and they're seeing enhanced productivity, reduced sickness absence, higher employee engagement, reduced aggravation in the system through formal complaints and so on, that we're going to be able to document. So we're looking for that kind of evidence. And what you find, of course, is that if you're good at recruiting disabled people, you become better at recruiting everyone. Our members are quite interested in the concept of the extreme user. If a system works for extreme users, anyone can come through. But what please researchers in the room stop doing is answering the question, are they employable? All these studies about whether or not 780 million people are employable. You know, some of them you wouldn't employ either. That's not the point. I sat in front of a select committee inquiry at the House of Commons, and these men, fairly hostile, looked at me and said, so what is the business case for hiring disabled people? And I said, I think it's the same as for hiring Canadian women. Because, of course, the question is, can I do the job? You know, that's the question. And if you can't focus on that, instead of getting hung up on whether or not technically I meet some kind of definition, then it's not going to work. I think what I'd like to do in the final few minutes here is talk about the system shift and what happens when you take a look at this issue through the eyes of the employer. Why is it that it was an employer's organization, albeit, you know, we're not for profit and we're working to the mutual benefit of business and disabled people, why was it that it was an employer's organization that did the first research into the impact of online recruitment and how it's discriminating against disabled people worldwide? If you could answer that question, you'll understand the resistance in the system to the kind of shifts that Barbara was asking for and that I'm asking for. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. If you're trying to get people with dyslexia into work, people with visual impairment, people with color blindness, people with English as a second language, and you don't notice that they can't get through online recruitment, you don't notice that actually all the psychometric test sites that people are being sent to are inaccessible, that the employer is knocking out anyone with a spelling mistake on an application form but won't let you use spell check. Why didn't the system do that? Why was it employers who did that? The revolution that you get here when you look at this through the employer's perspective. And so we have the world's only guidance on how to remove online recruitment obstacles. And it was one of the learnings, if you like, that led us to create the Business Task Force on Accessible Technology. McKinsey's did that research. Why did we use McKinsey's? Because one, they were hugely skeptical and didn't believe there was a problem. So if they said there was a problem, woo, must be real. And because people in positions of power will pay attention to McKinsey's, not to Scott Parker with this disability thing in her logo. So the McKinsey's work, 1.3 million people in the UK alone could not apply to 85% of the jobs available online. And the latest research from the EU, 75% of the FTSE 100 companies are using inaccessible websites. The Canadian government has had its own little na-na-na in that regard. However, we set up this task force, and for me, this is an example of how when you get business-to-business collaboration grounded in an understanding that actually getting this right benefits both parties, reinforced by daily and, you know, frequent contact with disabled individuals who are demonstrating the power of this technology to liberate their contribution to the business, you end up in a different place. So what we did was we brought chief information officers, chief technology officers, no diversity managers allowed near this. And if you can minimize contact with the diversity industry, but that's another matter. I'm not allowed to go there this morning. What we did was we brought these CIOs together and said, you need to diagnose what's getting in the way. You need to produce a strategic framework that makes it easier for your entire company to make progress on this. So we launched a 10-point charter called the Task Force Accessibility Charter. And it says things like, we'll allow people to personalize their workstations. The disability lobby gives people JAWS, but the employer can't figure out how to connect it and plug it into their system. We'll allow you to personalize your workstations. We'll train our people in the basics. And we will, and this is hugely exciting, we will not buy technology if it's inaccessible, unusable. We won't use IT help desks that are disability incompetent. And you get the combined purchasing power of billions. HMRC spent $1.4 billion, our tax department, last year on technology. He's in the chair of this task force, and he's saying, my business case is the average reading age of the citizens I want to fill in the forms online is between 9 and 11 years of age. So if my systems work for people with dyslexia, visual impairment, the extreme users, they're going to work for every citizen that I need to deal with. The task force has launched the world's first maturity model. If you go onto the Business Task Force Accessibility, Business BTAT, Business Task Force Accessible Technology, there's a maturity model that allows organizations of any size to measure their performance. Then the Barclays has given us a website, and we're going to have all the toolkits behind each of those 10. We're taking away every excuse not to do this that we can. Because if you say you don't know how to do that, there's your checklist. If you say my board won't let me, well, what do you mean? Ernst & Young have got it wrong, McDonald's have got it wrong, GlaxoSmithKline's got it wrong. You go down the list. And we're also putting together a training package that every IT professional working for a multinational should be exposed to. And last week, Barclays brought some of the biggest IT suppliers they have in Pune, together in Pune, India, to say we need you to start to address this as a priority so that we don't buy inaccessible stuff anymore, and we want you to start employing disabled people. Barbara's, you know, the push down the global supply chains here, I think, is going to be hugely helpful. And so I've run out of time, but I can't resist one more point, which is I don't see any research in my world that relates to what I do. The research that's produced by the universities and so on doesn't look at what the employer process is, how you do what I do. And so I'd love to talk to those of you that would like to build our business case website, help us perhaps pilot that standard here and learn from that. We're piloting it in Australia. Does it mean just putting a hockey player on the cover here? And we also need, and we need to take a look at understanding the role of the middle ground, the role of these service providers that never comes under adequate scrutiny. The wrong people are working in there to the wrong standards, if you can find any standards at all. How's that for a challenge? At a systemic level, I'm saying. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm going to be very quick now because we have something very special in the break, and so I want to make sure we get to it. We're going to ask people who have questions and comments to come up here during the break, but I'm not going to take it in the open form now. We will do that in every other session, but I don't want you to miss the chance to be able to see the poster presentation, so that's why we're going to make sure that we go to break now. Fellows have gone around the world to look at exciting case studies. You're going to see posters out there. Morgan Banks on disability coalitions in the U.S., Laura Benshoff, disability rights advocacy in India, Megan Galuccia, the U.K. example on employers' disability, Laura Califf, Norway, developing inclusive employment, Anna O'Kelly, the quota legislation in Brazil, Michelle Olding, Sweden and the Right to Work, and Kelly Stahl, Brazil, Cereza Company. They're great public and private examples, and you're going to be able to talk to them about what they saw. There are refreshments there. It's a chance to be able to talk to each other. And if you have questions, please come up afterwards. Anybody who wants assistance with anything, if you look for somebody with a yellow badge, that means their staff are volunteering. Thank you very much. Thank you.